Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thanks once again for joining us on the Explaining History podcast. And the thing I want to talk about today are Hitler's motivations for waging war in the Mediterranean, considering the fact that it was something that Hitler had in 1939 no intention of doing. The Mediterranean theatre, and particularly North Africa, absorb vital resources in terms of manpower, armour, air power, naval strength, and most critically, fuel. Hitler's objectives in the Mediterranean were highly ambiguous and unclear, and certainly didn't fall into the wider strategic vision that he pursued. Also, at moments where it might have fitted in with the wider strategic vision that Hitler had envisaged, i.e. perhaps a dash for Arabia, and the seizure of the Middle Eastern oil wells, which would have meant that Hitler wouldn't have had to get bogged down in southern Russia, then Hitler actually ignores this advice. Despite the fact that there were considerable successes for the Germans in North Africa and the Mediterranean, the fact is that the entire diversion into this theatre is really a huge strategic blunder. We've talked a lot recently about the strategic blunders that happen over the invasion, the planned invasion of Great Britain, and what a diversion, a sideshow, and a waste of time that basically was for Hitler. But I would argue that the Mediterranean is yet a bigger one. The development of an empire in the Mediterranean on its north and southern shores was obviously an Italian ambition. Mare Nostrum, our lake, was what the Mediterranean was referred to in fascist terms. And of course Mussolini sought to recreate roughly the boundaries and contours of the Roman Empire. Fascisms in general, wherever you go, tend to look back to antiquity or the Middle Ages for examples of national greatness and glory, and then attempt to project those into the modern era, into the present, in order to give a roadmap as to national rejuvenation, to kind of come back from the nation's problems, which obviously caused by outsiders and troublemakers and internal subversives. However, following the fall of France, the decision of Mussolini first to commit forces to the Balkans and to North Africa gave Churchill the opportunity to engage the Axis in battle, knowing that the European theatre was closed to the British for a considerable length of time. Why was this important? Why was it important that Churchill fight somewhere? Because he needed to present to the British public the idea that Britain was indeed fighting on. It was very difficult to show the results of Britain's fledgling air war over Germany, and it was very difficult to present to the British people successes at sea, and they were pretty thin on the ground in both cases. But victories in North Africa were much more tangible, and the evidence that the Axis was being fought and engaged and defeated in North Africa was much more tangible too. There is an interesting parallel between the Allied and the Axis forces. Mussolini's actions in the Mediterranean drew in a reluctant Hitler. The actions and the plans of Churchill in the Mediterranean also drew in a reluctant America. The view that the American chiefs of staff had from 1942 onwards was that the sooner a cross-channel invasion and a Titanic head-on attack with the German army could be had, so much the better. The British, who were probably right on this score, suggested that this was likely to be defeated and was too early in the war to be considered, and a long period of planning had to be thought through instead. The kind of war that Britain had traditionally fought was a war at the periphery. A head-on assault was something the British rarely tended to do. The previous wars from the 18th and the 19th century showed this clearly, particularly the Napoleonic Wars. And then in the First World War, the tendency of Churchill was to try to fight a war at the periphery as well, such as his rather ill-fated Dardanelles campaign. Mussolini had exhausted himself in North Africa and in Spain in the invasion of Abyssinia and the support that he gave to Franco during the Spanish Civil War. The period in which the British and the French and the Germans were busy rearming, Mussolini squandered on his rather pointless invasion of Abyssinia in order to bolster national pride and to undo defeats in the late 1890s at the hands of the Ethiopians. As a result, by 1940, when Mussolini sees the fall of France and decides that this is his cue to seize territories in North Africa, he goes to war fatally underprepared. When the British are finished fighting Mussolini and inflicting crushing defeats on him, fighting the Africa Corps is an entirely different proposition, and one which the British grapple with unsuccessfully for the best part of 2.5 years. And the reality is that Italy is a relatively poor country. Italy cannot commit the kinds of wealth to arms manufacture that Britain can. And then when Britain is no longer able to pour its resources into the war, it relies on the resources of the United States. So the British were always going to be able to outmatch the Italian army in North Africa. But especially when Mussolini made basic errors, such as not sending enough motorised transport for his men and relying on vast amounts of manpower across a desert in which it's virtually impossible to march. However, the threat that Mussolini posed in North Africa from the Italian colony in Libya towards Egypt was a serious one. If a large Italian force quickly swept across Egypt, taking the British unawares, and seized the canal zone, it would sever Britain from its empire. The loss of the Suez Canal would be a signal to Japan to seize the British colonies and other European colonies in Asia as quickly as possible before British Royal Naval reinforcements were able to arrive. The then head of the British Army, General Sir John Dill, wanted to send British troops to Asia as quickly as possible, every man that could be spared, to bolster imperial defences in India, Malaya, Singapore and Burma. Churchill was not pleased with this idea and thought that the battle should be brought to the enemy wherever possible, even if those battles were of little strategic value. Churchill said, well, it can't be Europe, so then it must be Africa. General Sir Archibald Wavell, whom Churchill loathed, and yet who was quite an effective commander, was given some of the best remaining hardware after the fall of France, vital tanks that could possibly have been used in other theatres, perhaps even in the defence of Great Britain, one might humbly submit, were sent to Wavell, who is there now the Commander-in-Chief of the British Middle Eastern Theatre, in the summer of 1940, and other measures were employed in order to protect Britain's position in the Mediterranean, particularly the defence of Gibraltar. It was strongly suspected that the Spanish dictator Franco would find some means of aiding Hitler to seize Gibraltar and thus seal off the Mediterranean. The reason why that didn't happen really relates to a meeting in the Pyrenees in Hitler's train carriage between Franco and Hitler, one where Franco asked for vast amounts of North African territory, much of it belonging to Vichy France and others earmarked for Mussolini, in order for participation in this fairly minor operation. Hitler was left shaking his head, saying, well, you know, the man is a fool, he wants everything for doing nothing, and I will have to offend, anger and disappoint Mussolini and Vichy France, two more far more powerful players as far as Hitler was concerned, in order for Franco sort of wetting his toe in the war. The fact that Franco survived till the 1970s tells you quite a lot about his acumen as a fascist leader in staying well out of the war. He had secured everything he wished to and managed to conquer Spain with immense bloodletting. And unlike Mussolini or Hitler, did not really have any kind of irredentist views or plans for Lebensraum. The fact that Gibraltar and also Malta didn't fall into enemy hands is one of the Britain's saving graces in the Mediterranean. The ability to resupply ships and to cut the distance of supply lines by stopovers on these islands, which is precisely why Britain had them in the first place, was of massive strategic value. Also, flying from Gibraltar and flying from Malta were the RAF, which covered Britain's ships, which were sadly lacking air cover of their own. There were insufficient aircraft carriers. Admiral Cunningham of the Mediterranean Fleet observed this one to his great concern in 1940. But by 1942-43, still there is a very relatively weak air cover over Britain's ships in the Mediterranean. The fact that British shipping, the Royal Navy in general, in the Mediterranean was quite an effective and powerful fighting force, inflicting several serious wounds on Axis naval forces without the sufficient air cover it deserved, is quite a testament to the power of the Royal Navy and the skill of its commanders. Britain's desert armies were quite a Spartan affair. There were a small number of divisions. The bulk of the British army was back home in Great Britain following the evacuation at Dunkirk. And Max Hastings has a rather magnificent way of putting their significance. The clashes between desert armies were little more significant in determining the outcome of global conflict than the tournaments between bands of French and English knights, which proved entree acts during the Hundred Years' War.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But the North African contest caught the imagination of the Western world and achieved immense symbolic significance in the minds of British people. There are numerous anecdotes of British soldiers and tank crews in North Africa who said that the war was 90% boredom and 10% terror, and that battles, tank battles in North Africa were kind of things that happened to other people, that you could sort of see the puff of gun smoke in the distance somewhere, there were nothing, you know, there were large expanses where fighting didn't happen. So this is a curious theatre of combat. It is symbolic combat. It is war that is fought for the sake of war being fought, for the appearance of war being fought, for the spectacle of it, in order mainly to keep morale on the home front high and to give the impression on the home front that the sacrifices of war really are being shared by men at the front, and that fighting on their behalf is going on, even if it is of relatively little consequence. The other curious thing to note about the Desert War in North Africa is that it happens over a thin strip of land between the Mediterranean coast and the beginnings of the impassable desert itself. This was normally 40 to 50 miles wide, and if you look at the Battle of El Alamein, on one side is the Mediterranean, and on the other are the deep and shifting sands of the Katara Depression, which was pretty much unnavigable by tanks and other forms of armour and mechanised transport. The main factors that came into play in the kind of the seesaw campaigns that saw the British and on one side and the Italians and Germans on the other pushed back and forth were fuel and supply lines. The longer the more successful a general became, particularly in the case of Rommel mid-1942, the more vulnerable the supply lines became, the more overstretched. When supply lines were short, when the British were pushed back to the borders of Egypt, and the supply lines between the front line and the Nile Delta were limited, the British tend to do their best fighting. When the Axis were close to their base in Tripoli, again, they tended to do their best fighting. Perhaps the most curious feature of the North African campaign is that none of the actual indigenous inhabitants of North Africa, Algerians, Libyans, Moroccans, and Egyptians, fought in any major capacity for either side. Here were two sets of imperial powers slugging it out in North Africa, ostensibly for the control of the Suez Canal, but as we've already discussed, for more obscure and less well-defined reasons too. The British and the Germans had little emotional attachment to the landscape, the people, or the culture, and weren't defending their own homelands. This is possibly why, whilst there were certainly horrors in fighting, it was no way near the kind of almost genocidal, actual genocidal brutality of the Russian front. Mussolini's main motivation for war in North Africa was based around the idea that he assumed the war by the summer of 1940 was over. He thought very quickly in the autumn of 1940 that territory had to be seized so that he could show his face at the peace conference, show what Italy's mighty achievements had been in the war, and then retain the territory that Italy had managed to seize. Mussolini's worldview was basically, and his view of the Italian people, was that the Italian people, whilst having been unified by 1870, were not really a people. They had not really been forged in the anvil of war and victory. The First World War was very unfortunate. Mussolini had campaigned for Italy to get into the First World War, and yet there was the terrible mutilated peace at the Paris Peace Conference, where Italy didn't get the spoils of war that Italian fascists and nationalists and even liberals believed that she should have. Mussolini believed all this could be undone and that the Italian people could be made great through war. And here we have a peculiar feature of fascism, that fascism looks to the positives of militarism and the positives of sacrifice, that the Italian people, through privation and struggle and muscular individualism, would become mighty and strong and cease being this kind of rather chaotic rabble that Mussolini perceived them to be. And when we speak of the British in North Africa, of course it's not the British at all, it's the British Empire, soon to be joined by the Allied forces from across Europe who are fighting in exile. The British contingent in Egypt was one division, which would be obviously the 7th Armoured Brigade, 7th Armoured Division, along with an Indian and New Zealand division and two Australian divisions. The British would be eventually joined in North Africa by South Africans, Poles, Czechs, French and others. And the final victory over Axis powers in North Africa would really be a multinational, almost United Nations effort. Most Egyptians were relatively sympathetic towards the Axis powers. This was partly as a result of having the British occupy the Canal Zone since 1882. The British were not particularly good house guests, and later one of the motivations for Egyptian nationalists embracing Colonel Nasser during the Suez Crisis in 1956 was the poor relations between the British Army and local Egyptians, normally caused by the British Army's actions itself. 70 years of British control over the canal and over Egypt itself, Egypt being notionally an independent sovereign state under its king, King Farouk, but really falling so deeply within a British sphere of influence that it had a little option other than to obey at the risk of a full military occupation. However, Egyptian and wider Arab sympathies towards the Axis, wanting to force out perfidious Albion, the British who they'd endured, the rest of Arabia had endured since 1919, didn't really register very deeply with Hitler. He wasn't that interested in what Arabs did or said. The fact of the matter was that much is made of the visit of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem to see Hitler in 1940. It's always a feature on various cable TV history shows. Was the Grand Mufti a secret Nazi? Well, the answer is, well, no, he wasn't. In essence, the enemy of his enemy was his friend. And Hitler met with him made vague and rather specious promises of arms and assistance, nothing that ever really materialises. But the reality is that Hitler did do this from time to time. He did meet with people that he sort of entertained might be possibly useful in the future and talk a big fight to them with very little to follow it up. So it's important not to really kind of flam that one up too much. The Nazis were not interested in the Arab cause, and there's not, in my mind, a great deal of evidence to suggest that Arab anti-Jewish feeling and Nazi anti-Semitism really tied up into any kind of central kind of shared set of ideas. And when later on the Nazis do attempt to meddle in Mesopotamia and in Persia, the British stamp on this very quickly, and they have no intention of allowing any kind of Arab or Persian nationalism to disrupt British oil supplies. Mussolini's abilities to have any kind of diplomatic influence in North Africa and the Middle East are pretty minimal. The people that he's attempting to induce to support the Axis powers are those that he, in places like Libya and Abyssinia, had been violently suppressing since the 1930s. With the outbreak of war in 1939, Egypt reverts in essence to being a British colony. The Anglo-Egyptian Treaty, I think of 1882, but you can check me on that one, was invoked, a particular clause of it was invoked in order to give the British direct control over Egypt, where the all facilities and assistances in the King Farouk's power, including the use of ports, aerodromes and means of communication, were to be handed over to Great Britain. And the Mediterranean fleet docked at Alexandria. The existence of a growing army in Egypt inevitably led food supplies to be diverted from Egyptian peasants, the Fellahin, the poor landless peasants in Egypt, towards military consumption. It's periodically, wherever you look throughout the Second World War, there are moments of hunger and indeed famine that follow the deployment of military forces into a food insecure area. British men and officers didn't have this problem, of course, and lived very well. Cairo was a centre for entertainment for the troops and for weekend pursuits for the officers. But British racism towards the Egyptians meant that there were no white faces in any of the officers' clubs except people who were serving drinks. And the offensive term the British soldiers reserved for Egyptian locals was the wog. American diplomats and journalists who went to see Britain's fighting efforts in the North African theatre often came across this sort of attitude, and they came across the gentlemanly amateurism of British officers. And much of the credit that Britain had built up for itself in the summer of 1940 with the United States, showing that it was ready to fight and ready to fight well and in a disciplined manner and commit to the struggle, thus inspiring the American general public and Roosevelt himself and the Houses of Congress to support the British war effort with material and equipment and eventually fighting men, this was undermined by the attitudes that were perceived by American journalists and diplomats in Cairo and Alexandria. Now, there's a lot to say about the North African campaign, weeks worth of material really, so we're going to continue on with that bit by bit, and we'll have some more on North Africa and the war there coming for you soon. Anyway, I hope you found this useful. Do check us out on Patreon, and if you can give us a good review on iTunes, that'd be great. And also, don't forget, there's the Explaining History YouTube channel where I talk about study techniques and all that kind of business. So find us on YouTube and subscribe there, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.